Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We're going to start in the Hollywood section, move to the arts and culture section, and then round it out with politics as usual. Our first is Hollywood and current events. George and Amal Clooney evacuate their French villa amid wildfires. Clooney, who will receive the Golden Lion for Lifetime Achievement at the Venice Film Festival in September, is having a rather turbulent summer. This is by Alessandra De Tomasi on July 31st. This isn't exactly how George Clooney imagined this summer would go. At the upcoming Venice Film Festival, September 2nd through 12th, he will receive the Golden Lion for Lifetime Achievement, and in the weeks leading up to it, he had planned a quiet, relaxing time with his wife, Amal, and their twins, Alexander and Ella, age 9, at their villa in France. Instead, they had to evacuate their home in Brignoles in the south of France due to the wildfires ravaging the surrounding areas. The star of Ocean's 11 wrote a letter to the town's mayor after the evacuation, which his spokesperson confirmed to People magazine. "At this point, we have no idea whether our beautiful home makes it through this terrible moment," the letter reads. It continues, "As we evacuate Brignoles, we wanted to emphasize two things. First, we hope you and the people of our city are safe. And second, that Amal and I are committed to making sure that whatever happens to our village, we are part of this community and will be part of making it whole." According to CNN's reporting, over 3,000 people have been displaced in the same region of France, while the Associated Press estimates that the fires cover an area equivalent to four times the size of Paris. Clooney and Amal, who are now French citizens, have decided to raise their children away from Hollywood in an effort to give them a healthier, simpler life. "For this reason," the star explained, "he decided to buy a farm like the one where he grew up. Not that it's his only home, of course. He also owns Villa Oleandra on Lake Como, as well as a property in England and one near his family home in Kentucky. A few weeks ago, the power couple was spotted in Capri, and some were already speculating that they might be buying a new property in Campania. For now, it seems that the star's resources are entirely focused on keeping his family safe, but the location where he will spend the near future with his wife and children has not been disclosed. One thing is certain, as he told the New York Times in 2025, although as a child he wanted to escape to a place as far away as possible from the farm where he grew up, today it seems almost surreal to him to enjoy a bit of wholesome normalcy while riding a tractor. Thanks in part to the emotional stability Amal provides, Clooney finally feels free from the pressures and scrutiny of show business, much to the chagrin of President Donald Trump, who did not appreciate the change in citizenship. Next up in the Hollywood section, a little Hollywood gossip, I guess. Tom Cruise's daughter is reportedly registered to vote under the name Suri Noel. Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes' only child reportedly hasn't had any contact with her father for about 10 years. This is by Alessia Ferry on July 30th. Father's last names in Hollywood seems to be becoming quite a burden. After several of Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt's children turned 18 and dropped Pitt from their names in favor of solely using their mother's last name, a Hollywood child has made a similar decision. Suri, the only child of Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes, has reportedly changed her name to Suri Noel. Page Six was the first to report that Suri, now a student at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has registered to vote in Allegheny County under the name Suri Noel. According to the outlet, the change likely took place in 2024 during her freshman year of college. Page Six also reports that Suri did not file an application to change her name in Allegheny County, leading to speculation that she did so in New York, where she lived before starting college, and where name change requests are typically sealed. Noel is Katie Holmes' middle name. The decision to adopt it in place of Cruise's surname might suggest a desire to honor her mother. Holmes primarily raised Suri and has always been present during the most important moments of her daughter's life, such as when she got her college acceptance, for which the Dawson's Creek alum expressed great pride. "Of course, I will miss the close proximity, but I'm really proud of her and I'm happy," Holmes told Town & Country in 2024. As for her father, Suri reportedly has no contact with Cruise in over 10 years. Holmes and Cruz were married in November 2006, 7 months after their only child was born in April of the same year. For a time, the three appeared to be a close-knit unit, often captured by the paparazzi in moments of harmony. However, their marriage didn't last, and the couple divorced in 2012. Holmes was awarded primary legal custody of her daughter, and Cruz reportedly has not been seen with Suri since shortly after the divorce. He's reportedly stayed involved in her life by paying child support throughout Suri's childhood. She was already referred to as Suri Noel at her high school graduation ceremony at LaGuardia High School in 2024. It is also the name that appears on the playbill for Midsummer, a modern adaptation of William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, in which she is currently performing alongside other college students at the Pierce Studio of the Trust Arts Education Center in Pittsburgh. The most widely speculated theory has been that it was a stage name intended to protect her privacy and allow her to form her own identity. However, it now seems the change is a permanent one. Next up in Hollywood, Tom Holland is king of the summer box office. Now it's time for him to grow up. With The Odyssey and Spider-Man Brand New Day, the 30-year-old actor is poised to be the king of the box office this summer for playing two childish roles. We think it's time for the actor to hang up the tights. This is by Chris Murphy on July 28th. A new king has ascended the throne in Ithaca, and the summer movie season as well. Tom Holland, who stars in The Odyssey and Spider-Man Brand New Day, is having a major moment this summer. The Odyssey is already a critical and commercial smash, raking in more than $650 million globally after just two weekends, and Spider-Man Brand New Day is set to make a killing when it hits theaters on Friday, July 31st. If prognostications are correct, The Odyssey is on track to earn anywhere from $1.1 billion to $1.3 billion at the box office, while Spider-Man Brand New Day, the long-awaited follow-up to 2021's Spider-Man No Way Home, which grossed a massive $1.9 billion, is tracking to make $180 million to $190 million in its opening weekend, which would make it the biggest domestic opening of the year. If everything goes according to plan, Holland could be very well the actor at the center of a $2 billion-plus summer box office haul. Of course, Holland isn't the only actor who appears in both of these massive films. His wife, Zendaya, also appears in The Odyssey and Spider-Man Brand New Day, sitting at the top of the box office throne with her husband. Talk about a power couple. But Zendaya's roles in The Odyssey, where she has a grand total of about 5 minutes of screen time, and Spider-Man Brand New Day, where she plays Peter Parker's love interest, MJ, are smaller than those of her husband, who plays the titular role in Spider-Man and has one of the meatier major supporting parts in the star-studded Odyssey, portraying Telemachus, the son of Matt Damon's Odysseus and Anne Hathaway's Penelope. With Dune Part 3 on the horizon for December, Zendaya is primed to be the undisputed box office champion of 2026. Fun fact, Benny Safdie, Holland and Zendaya's Odyssey co-star, is currently the highest-grossing film actor of 2026, thanks to that film and the Super Mario Galaxy movie. Not bad for the director of The Smashing Machine. But make no mistake, as far as male movie stars go, Holland is the king of this summer. It may feel a bit odd that the baby-faced Holland has joined the ranks of major action movie stars like Tom Cruise, Will Smith, and Chris Pratt. But at 30 years old, Holland is 3 years older than a 27-year-old Smith was when Independence Day debuted in 1996, and a jaw-dropping seven years older than Cruise was when he dominated the box office with Top Gun at 23 years old in 1986. Despite, or rather because of, his boyish charm, Holland has reached the peak of male movie stardom. But after Spider-Man Brand New Day, it's time, we think, for Holland to hang up the superhero tights and begin the journey to taking on more adult roles. Taken at face value, this might seem like bad advice. Clearly, Holland's career is going quite well. Whatever happened to "if it ain't broke, don't fix it"? It's true that Holland has convincingly portrayed the teenage Peter Parker for a decade, having first swung into the role in 2016's Captain America: Civil War. But thanks to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, his Spider-Man has gotten a lot more mileage than the previous Peter Parkers, Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield. Maguire starred in a trilogy of Spider-Man movies between 2002 and 2007, while Garfield only starred in two Amazing Spider-Man movies from 2012 to 2014. Both Maguire and Garfield joined Spider-Man No Way Home for a cameo, bringing the number of times they've each played Peter Parker to 4 and 3, respectively. Now take a look at the number of times Holland has played Peter Parker. Going into Brand New Day, Holland had played Peter Parker in 6 feature films, 3 standalone Spider movies, Homecoming 2017, Far From Home 2019, and 2021's No Way Home, The Kid Loves Home, and 3 crossover Avenger films, Captain America Civil War 2016, Avengers Infinity War 2018, and Avengers Endgame 2019. Add in this summer's Brand New Day, and Holland will have starred as Spider-Man in the same number of movies as Maguire and Garfield combined. And a quick scan of Hollywood's very long IMDb page will show you that Holland's Spider-Man web reaches far beyond feature films. He's played or voiced Peter Parker in a number of shorts and video games, from Fortnite Chapter 3 in 2021 to Spider-Man Brand New Day Superfan Messi 2026. That's a lot of Peter Parker. As a result, Holland is more defined by Peter Parker than his forebears, which is a double-edged sword. Sure, it's proof that he can reliably lead a multi-billion dollar tentpole franchise, but he's also more likely to get pigeonholed and stuck in audiences' minds as that kid with the Spidey sense. And not for nothing, Holland's non-Peter Parker work has struggled to hit with the mainstream audiences. In 2020, Holland starred in Netflix's The Devil All the Time opposite his future Odyssey co-star Robert Pattinson, where he played a young man growing up in rural Ohio following World War II. The film received mixed reviews. In 2021, he led the film Chaos Walking opposite Daisy Ridley, about a man who lives in a dystopian society without women, and also fronted Cherry, where he portrayed a college dropout turned Iraq war veteran who robs banks to fund his and his wife's drug addiction. While he received some positive notices for the decidedly grown-up Cherry, both projects failed to make a dent in the larger entertainment landscape, and Holland is aware of this. He recently told the podcast Dish that it was difficult doing press for some of his past movies that he considered shit and thought people shouldn't watch. He didn't name names, but it wouldn't be surprising if he were referring to Chaos Walking, which holds a 21% on Rotten Tomatoes. But thankfully, then came the Odyssey. Given the perpetual boyhood Holland has found himself in as a result of his decade as a Spider-Man, he was a natural choice to play Telemachus, the son of Odysseus, who's transitioning from boyhood to adulthood and isn't quite yet ready to rule Ithaca. But even with Holland's role seeming tailor-made to his strengths, many have felt that Holland wasn't able to hold his own against his more seasoned co-stars like Hathaway. Variety, somewhat rudely, put him dead last in its ranking of Odyssey performances, writing that nearly every line delivery lacks conviction. Ouch. Holland should be commended for leaving the safety and comfort of a Marvel lot and giving it his best try in a Christopher Nolan film. Leading up to the Odyssey's release, Holland went viral for his amazement at Nolan's level of preparation and how he ran the movie's set. One also assumes the practical effects on set made it a far cry from his days in front of a Marvel green screen. But until he untangles himself from Spider-Man's web once and for all, it's going to be hard to believe Holland in roles that are fit for his still-developing but legitimate acting chops. For what it's worth, Holland has suggested that he might be ready to see what else is out there. In 2021, he told GQ, "If I'm playing Spider-Man after I'm 30, I've done something wrong." Well, that moment has come, but in a 2026 GQ cover story, Holland changed his tune. "I think the truth is that playing Spider-Man has been the joy of my life," he said. "I now kind of stand on the plinth of, like, I'll do it for as long as they'll have me." "No, Tom, you were right in 2021. You've had a good run, but it's time to move on. Other actors have made the journey from boyhood to adulthood before. Leonardo DiCaprio, Timothy Chalamet, and it might behoove Holland to take a page out of their book as he reaches that point in his own career. It seems he might be already taking tips from Chalamet, who cemented his status as a real adult actor with an Oscar nomination for starring as Bob Dylan in the musical biopic A Complete Unknown. Holland's long-gestating Fred Astaire biopic is reportedly finally in rehearsal and could be just the ticket for transitioning the actor into full-fledged leading man territory. He's got the moves. He played Billy Elliot on the West End as a kid. So here's hoping that after Brand New Day makes $1 billion, Holland is able to resist Spider-Man's siren song. If not, it's okay. His wife has figured out the whole transition from child star to A-list actor thing. He can always take pointers from her. So this next article is a little bit out of the norm. It's from the arts and culture section, and the headline is science with a question mark. The newest status symbol in longevity circles, a top 1% vagina. Move over blood boys and peptides. Influencers, startups, and venture capital are suddenly working overtime to help women optimize their genitals. This is by Sarah DeGregorio on July 27th. Brian Johnson, the world's most dedicated oversharer, is in love. The 48-year-old got famous for documenting his strict diet and elaborate regimen of supplements, many of which he also sells, as well as exotic therapies, including an injection of young Swedish stem cells, all in the pursuit of not dying, ever. And after he got a girlfriend, he told his public more than they'd ever want to know. I just gave Kate oral sex. Good night, everyone, he tweeted this spring. Alas, there was more. This is her vaginal microbiome report. 100 out of 100 score. Top 1% of all vaginas. What followed was a report from a vaginal microbiome test confirming the elite status of Kate Tolo's. This, Johnson claimed, was a critical marker of Tolo's overall health. He soon began referring to his girlfriend's genitals as Kate's 1%. Tolo then leapt into the comments, reassuring followers that she was totally fine with the world knowing that the bugs in her vagina are the very best bugs. Everyone with a vagina has a vaginal microbiome, just like everyone has an ecosystem of microorganisms living in and on their stomach, mouth, skin, and even their eyelashes. There is evidence that the particular mix of beneficial and harmful bacteria that live on us affect our health in complex ways. The female body, however, has historically been an afterthought for longevity bros and the medical industry alike. Women were not even routinely included in medical research until the 1990s, and just uttering vagina can still be a problem in some circles. The new enthusiasm for measuring and enhancing the vagina is a notable departure from that history. And predictably, sleek startups like Evie, June Bio, Tiny Health, and Day are rushing to offer direct-to-consumer test kits and coaching, while Evie and Day also offer probiotics and supplements that claim to optimize the vagina. It's a gold rush that's attracting venture capital, all in the pursuit of either telling women to quantify and optimize an additional body part or helping close a painful gap in women's healthcare, depending on your point of view. Kate 1% Tolo is now pitching herself as the world's most measured woman. Other female longevity influencers are also lining up for the swab. Kayla Barnes-Lenz told her hundreds of thousands of followers that she tests her vagina often, and yes, my score is also 100. She argues that the vagina is one of the most overlooked aspects of women's health. Of course, she's right about that last bit. There's always some truth and benefit mixed in with profit in the consumer space around women's health, says Kemi Dahl, MD, a gynecological oncologist, professor at the University of Washington, and author of the recent book, A Terrible Strength. Priyanka Jain, a 31-year-old Stanford-educated entrepreneur who comes from Silicon Valley royalty, her father and brother are both tech moguls, agrees. Jane says that she's got the idea for her company, Evie, while navigating her own health issues and rediscovering that difficult-to-treat vaginal discomfort is one of the main reasons that women seek gynecological care. That's because nearly 30% of American women have bacterial vaginosis, or BV, an overgrowth of certain harmful bacteria. Antibiotics often work temporarily to fix the problem, but upwards of 60% of BV cases reoccur. Taking certain probiotics can also increase the share of good bacteria, but that doesn't work universally or in the long term. So some women find themselves on a years-long roller coaster of BV, yeast infections, and UTIs, doing everything their gyno recommends to no avail. BV isn't just uncomfortable, though discomfort itself is a big deal. It's associated with higher risk of miscarriage, preterm birth, and STIs. But because we don't know if the microbiome is causing these outcomes or just correlated with them, researchers can't yet say whether or not any particular treatment for BV will actually prevent those outcomes. Uncertainty notwithstanding, the longevity world has glommed onto the notion that the vaginal microbiome is some kind of exotic tea leaf that can be deciphered and perfected by purchasing the right supplements. It doesn't hurt that scientists have roughly categorized vaginal microbiomes into five common community state types. Community as in bacteria, a development that's both genuinely amazing and also gives the whole endeavor the air of taking a test to find out if you're a true autumn or an ENFJ on the Myers-Briggs. Unlike Johnson, Evie, at least, doesn't quantify results as a competitive score. One major vector for longevity content, of course, is podcasts. And not all the podcast bros are quite ready for a conversation about vaginas. When Jane recently appeared on biohacker and bulletproof coffee founder Dave Asprey's podcast, The Human Upgrade, the difficulty was immediately apparent. Asprey kept coming back around to longevity bros' favorite topic, the dick. He asked if semen was good for the vaginal microbiome. "It's bad, definitely bad," Jane said. "Doesn't it depend on the semen?" he asked hopefully. "Not really, because of the alkaline nature of the semen," she replied. "A vagina is supposed to be acidic." "What about oral?" "Also, not great." Long story short, the less disruption you have into the vaginal microbiome, the better. That's why Jane and some gynecologic experts now recommend treating male partners when women have recurrent BV, because new evidence suggests that bacteria associated with BV can be transmitted between sexual partners. When she said this to Asprey, you could practically hear the sad trombone. Experts like Dahl said that while some women may benefit from biome tests, if your vagina feels fine, there's zero reason to think that you actually need one. And she's not a fan of the idea that some vaginas are better than others. "The fact that we are numerically scoring the bacterial makeup of the vagina," says Dahl, "that has to be some kind of indicator of falling off the cliff. We have lost the plot." Dahl points out that many people whose tests now show a large share of bad bacteria don't actually have any negative symptoms. There are differences in the microbiome across location, race and ethnicity, and age, and what might be a problem for one person may be perfectly healthy for another. But now they have a report marking them as in the red zone. So what do you think they're going to do? They're going to go buy the supplement. That part is exploitative if that person actually wasn't having any problems. Jane responded that most of their clients either currently have BV or have dealt with the recurrent infections in the past. "Most patients come to us when there's a symptom or question to investigate, and our focus is helping those patients get the right diagnosis and treatment." She added that many customers are already on a probiotic anyway, but switch to Evie's formula. Okay, but can a great, a 1%er even, vagina help you live longer? Does it mean a woman is among the elite or at least healthier than her friends? Caroline Mitchell, MD, is the director of the Vulvovaginal Disorders Program at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor at Harvard Medical School. She's currently running a study to see if a vaginal microbiome can be transplanted from a healthy patient to one who has been treated for BV, to see if a protective bacterial community can be established that way, much like a poop transplant. Like Dahl, Mitchell understands women's frustrations and the appeal of taking one's vagina into one's own hands. But she's also concerned by what many of these companies market as solutions. "I was trying to have an open mind until a patient brought me their results and said, 'This is what the company recommended,' she said. And to me, clinically, that recommendation was wrong." Pressed to gauge how much influence the vaginal microbiome actually has on any given woman's overall health, Mitchell was a bit less bullish than Brian Johnson. "In terms of full body health and wellness, the gut microbiome is by far and away more likely to impact that," she says. "The vaginal microbiome might mean your vagina is happy until 120, but I don't think it's going to change your life expectancy." So if the bad news is that your vagina won't make you live forever, the good news is that it's probably not going to kill you either. We're going to do a quick check-in in the royals section before we move to politics. The tragic incident that prompted Queen Elizabeth to revise the royal dress code for travel. Although all members of the royal family now routinely pack a black outfit when traveling, this protocol has not always been in effect. This is by Matilda Engelman on July 31st. Queen Elizabeth II proved, quite unwittingly, that the little black dress is a wardrobe staple. Today, all members of the royal family routinely pack a black outfit in their luggage when traveling on official business. This is a protocol established following a moment in the crown's history that was as significant as it was tragic. In February 1952, while on an official trip to Kenya with Prince Philip, the young Princess Elizabeth learned of the sudden death of her father, King George VI. At just 25 years old, she had to return immediately to the United Kingdom, but realized she had only packed summer dresses and no mourning attire. The king, weakened by lung cancer, had passed away in his sleep at Sandringham. It fell to Prince Philip to break the terrible news to his wife while the couple was staying near Mount Kenya. Since then, tradition dictates that every member of the royal family travel with a black outfit, ready to be worn in the event of a death. Thus, upon her arrival in London, Queen Elizabeth II did not immediately leave the plane. A black outfit was brought to her so she could change before appearing in public. Wearing a black coat with a black hat, she stepped onto the tarmac at Heathrow Airport, where Prime Minister Winston Churchill was waiting for her. This episode, as memorable as it was embarrassing, led to a lasting change in royal protocol. Since then, all members of the royal family have routinely packed a black outfit for their official trips. Furthermore, in 1992, this dress code was observed when Princess Diana's father, Lord Spencer, passed away while she was in the Alps skiing with her then-husband, Prince Charles. For the return trip, the royal couple was therefore, in keeping with tradition, dressed entirely in black. Next up, Prince William and Kate Middleton released their summer adventure photos. The Prince and Princess of Wales shared on an Instagram carousel, including highlights from family travels with George, Charlotte, and Louis. This is by Matilda Engelman on July 30th. This summer is all about family for Kate Middleton and Prince William. On Tuesday, they shared a glimpse of their special moments on Instagram. The Prince and Princess of Wales posted a series of photos under the title Summer Rewind, revealing some precious moments from the past few months in a photo carousel with some very Instagram-worthy looks. The series opens with a particularly touching image, William and Kate sitting on the grass, surrounded by their three children, Prince George, who just celebrated his 13th birthday, Princess Charlotte, 11, and Prince Louis, who is 8. The heartwarming family portrait captures the moment of togetherness before an important new chapter for the eldest, who is set to begin boarding school at Eton College this fall. Thank you to everyone who has made the last few months so special, reads the caption. But this retrospective isn't limited to private moments. The royal couple also offers a behind-the-scenes look at their many official engagements. Among the images shared are photos of Kate and William in front of their Buckingham Palace during a garden party held on May 8th, where the heir to the throne appeared wearing an elegant top hat and the princess wore a stunning polka dot ensemble. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We're currently in the middle of an article about Prince William and Princess Kate's summer memories. The royal family also made headlines this summer with an appearance at Wimbledon. Kate, a huge tennis fan, presented the trophy to the winner of the women's tournament, Linda Noskova, a moment captured in the video montage accompanying the post. Other clips highlight the causes that are particularly close to the couple's hearts. Kate is seen talking with a former patient at the Christie Cancer Center during her visit in June. For his part, William was photographed speaking with the renowned British naturalist and television presenter David Attenborough during his celebration of his 100th birthday. Among other notable encounters, William can be seen sharing a ride on an iconic London bus with his friend Robert Irwin to attend the Earthshot Prize Impact Assembly. He also posed for a photo with Emma Watson and Benedict Cumberbatch during a forum dedicated to the Royal Foundation's United for Wildlife initiative held during Climate Action Week in London. Between family moments, public appearances, and charitable engagements, this retrospective offers a glimpse into a particularly emotional summer for the Prince and Princess of Wales. We are moving over to the politics section. Our first headline, RFK Jr.'s cooking show is even more bizarre than you could imagine. Considering the guy is known for all kinds of strangeness in the biome, from protein to emus to brain worms, the Real Food Show is quite the surreal experience. This is by Casey Wickman on July 31st. Our scene unfolds in a kitchen worthy of a Nancy Meyers movie. Monochrome dishes stacked neatly in open shelving, tasteful beigey tile backsplash with a hint of opalescence, stark white range hood with decorative tone-on-tone molding, so many lemons. Who needs that many lemons within arm's reach at a given moment? Both Meghan Markle and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., newly minted YouTube cooking show host, apparently. Yes, Kennedy, Maha Maestro and Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services under Donald Trump, has taken his culinary talents to the streaming space, releasing the first episode of The Real Food Show on Thursday. Andrew Gruhl, a chef and member of the Huntington Beach City Council in California, guested on the first episode where the duo made salmon cakes and arugula salad, a meal they claimed would cost under $5 a portion for a family of four, and which Kennedy declared amazing after taking a single bite on camera. "I'm traveling across America, connecting with renowned chefs to show families how to cook delicious, nutritious meals with real ingredients at all affordable prices," Kennedy says at the beginning of the video, which clocks in at just under 20 minutes. "America, it's time to eat real food." From here, Kennedy takes more than just visual cues from the Duchess of Sussex's Netflix series with Love, Meghan. Both feature our celebrity host and a friend chatting while cooking together, while promoting their personal agendas. For Meghan, her message is one of normalcy. She's just a mom, a gal with gal pals and a busy life, albeit one that comes with a noble title, and mom's gotta eat. They must also play Mahjong, Natch. Kennedy, on the other hand, is donning a tasteful neutral apron, manly khaki, don't get it wrong, to get the word out about his upside-down food pyramid overhaul and to prove that men can get into the kitchen and eat a protein that isn't red meat without being a sissy. "We have a lot of seafood in this country, and we're used to eating meat and think of that as our protein," he said in the video. "Today, we have the lowest level of cattle herds in history, in at least 100 years. The cost of meat has gone up, and we're doing everything we can in the administration to bring that down and increase the size of the herd. But until that happens, this is a fantastic option." In an interview with USA Today promoting the project, Kennedy claimed that home cooking is a sacred ritual that has been abandoned, despite data showing that more than half of American men and three-quarters of women regularly cook at home. He said in the same interview that his own culinary specialties include steak, burgers, fish, and omelets, the last of which he credited Gruhl with teaching him to cook. Throughout the episode, both Gruhl and Kennedy employ dog whistles of varying overtness. Gruhl assures viewers that he'll be using a couple chef tricks, but nothing overly intellectual. None of that namby-pamby liberal glasses polishing here to pack in flavor, while Kennedy knocked old nutritional guidelines, claiming that the government had been lying to us and telling us that protein caused heart attacks. There was no science that supported that. Source, please. The siren song of Maha's love affair with protein maxing is also well represented in this first episode, with noted animal lover Kennedy grimly intoning, "One of the things we found when we started looking at the real science was that when you don't eat protein, you eat something else, and it was ultra-processed foods." As for Gruhl, he doesn't seem too worried about viewers cooking well. "Now don't worry if you overcook this," he says of the dish. He also focuses on the cost of ingredients without noting the trade-offs that might come with choices that will lower the grocery bill, such as nutritional difference between a fish fillet and canned fish, or the difference between different types of eggs. He recommends using panko as a binder in the cakes, assuring the audience that it's really just a lightened breadcrumb. Is it any wonder that multiple commenters on the video suggesting using pork rinds, which are high in fat and sodium and not a good source of vitamins, in the place of panko? The Department of Health and Human Services had not responded to Vanity Fair's request for comment at publication time and has not shared plans for the frequency of new episodes. Gruel, throughout the episode, stands along recovering addict Kennedy and claims to be addicted to many things. Seafood, positive. Salad dressing, negative. Condiments, negative. And seed oils, negative. Another stab at humor falls similarly awkwardly. Gruel mentions involving his four children in food prep, claiming that if they help cook the food, they're more likely to eat it. Common enough advice in parenting articles about picky eaters, but then adds, "We've got restaurants and labor cost is high, so I keep having more kids so we have free labor." Kennedy, who positioned his food pyramid overhaul as finding top nutritionists and then locking them in a room for 11 months, replied, "Good plan, and hey, the pronatalism comes free of charge." Another upside from Gruel, "I've also learned in California, kids can't sue you, so that's helpful." Lifestyle guru indeed. Whatever Kennedy's future as a celebrity chef holds, he'll be able to choke it down, he assured USA Today, saying, "I will literally eat anything because I don't have a gag reflex." Bon appetit, America. Next up in politics and current events, the White House says it won't intervene in the Tate brothers' case. The Tate brothers don't think that's wise. Andrew Tate was a material participant in ensuring President Trump's victory, Joseph McBride, his longtime lawyer, tells Vanity Fair. But as the influencer and his brother face extradition to the United Kingdom on rape and sex trafficking charges, Caroline Levitt says the president won't step in. Has the manosphere lost its political cachet? This is by Dan Adler on July 30th. Earlier this month, Andrew and Tristan Tate strutted around Washington as MAGA royalty. There was an appearance at a private summer party hosted by Paolo Zampoli, a former modeling agent and a special envoy for Donald Trump, who introduced him to Melania in 1998, followed by a stop at the NED, D.C.'s premier members club as of this presidential term. There was a meeting and photo op with Texas Congressman Wesley Hunt. In the early days of Trump's return to office, Romanian prosecutors who charged the ubiquitous masculinity influencers with human trafficking in 2023 had lifted a travel ban against them after reported lobbying from the U.S. officials. The Tate brothers documented their Washington welcome extensively on social media, carrying themselves less like accused rapists and pimps than bulletproof dignitaries. It was surprising, then, to see the footage that emerged after the Tates returned last weekend to the Manosphere hub of Miami. Federal agents arrested Andrew, wearing a half-buttoned purple mesh shirt and his customary ultra-cropped, ultra-tight pants, and Tristan in a rigid three-piece suit, after British authorities brought 38 new sex crime charges against the brothers, bringing the total counts against them there to 59, and made an extradition request that left prosecutors working for Trump's Justice Department fighting on the United Kingdom's behalf. The brothers, whose adult webcam business powered their initial 2010s rise, have denied all allegations against them in the UK, US, and Romania. They are currently being held in Miami federal detention without bail as the UK extradition process plays out. Their case in Romania has faced delays pending procedural issues, and the country's then foreign minister denied facing US pressure to lift their travel ban in February 2025. Despite the recent fanfare in Trump's D.C. and the alleged intervention in the travel ban, the administration seems content to let the extradition process unfold as usual. "There's no role for us to play at this moment," Marco Rubio, who holds final say over the process as Secretary of State, told reporters last week, "or maybe ever in that regard, but I'm not going to opine on that." The next day, Caroline Levitt offered a flat no in the White House press briefing room when asked whether the administration plans to intervene in the extradition. Did the Tate brothers take a wrong turn in Trump world? Is it simply too much to expect that the U.S. would make a rare exception to its long-standing extradition treaty with the U.K.? Or are the stars of the manosphere, once considered a vital pathway to the young male electorate of 2024, no longer influential enough to go to bat for? Over two interviews with Vanity Fair, Joseph McBride, a longtime lawyer for the brothers, said that any hypothetical intervention from Trump would take away from the fact that we could say they were right all along. Still, he insisted that such backing would be warranted. Andrew Tate was a material participant in ensuring President Trump's victory, McBride says, and if Trump doesn't support him, and if the next people who are going to be running for office potentially are just like, yeah, down the river he goes, that young cohort of people will break with the Republican Party in the next election. McBride saw it as a given that MAGA couldn't afford to lose his clients, writing on Instagram, AOC will be the next president without the Manosphere and Andrew Tate. If your superhero is betrayed by somebody, he says, the person who's betrayed them, how can you ever support them again? Bombastic as he sounded, McBride, a strident Brooklyn-bred content creator, otherwise known for his representation of January 6th rioters, and prominent Trump advisor Alex Brusevitz, wasn't too far off from the mainstream consensus that formed around the 2024 campaign. The Tates are among the most extreme influencers targeting the hordes of young men whom Trump visibly courted with his run of comedy and sports podcast appearances that year. They often compared the accusations they faced to those made against Trump, once earning a Truth Social shout-out for it. McBride drew the same parallel in regard to E. Jean Carroll and Stormy Daniels when we spoke, saying, if they want to throw stuff at the wall at you and this is what they do. With their self-help doctrine of masculine conquest and female subordination, the brothers have inspired social media bans, fear in the hearts of teenage boys' parents across the globe, and a Netflix series wrestling with the consequences of their message. But their popularity, along with their trademark theory of an unseen matrix suppressing independent thought, helped make inroads with conservative personalities. I guess some Americans call the Matrix the deep state, Andrew said in an appearance on Tucker Carlson's podcast in 2023, but I like to look at it in a more global way. The alignment appeared to pay off when the Tates were allowed to leave Romania. Trump special envoy Rick Grenell, a public supporter of the Tates, had reportedly raised their case with Romanian officials at an international security conference in Munich. The Tates' triumphant return to Miami functioned as something of a litmus test for the conservative personalities, with some declaring that their brand of masculinity had no place in the party. Trump himself took a decidedly neutral stance that didn't ostracize his celebrity fans. When asked in the Oval Office whether his administration had lobbied Romania to lift the travel ban, he said, "I know nothing about that." After a hearing last week, McBride fielded a question about whether he expected an intervention from the president or secretary of state. I believe that Marco Rubio and the rest of the Trump administration are not fans of communism, McBride told reporters wearing sunglasses and a snug suit in the style of his clients and their self-described third brother, the influencer Justin Waller, who stood by his side. They're not fans of prosecuting people for free speech. As I reported last year, Waller, an Alabaman steel entrepreneur who later pivoted to selling online mentorship under banners such as Hustlers University alongside the Tates, visited Trump's then 18-year-old son Barron at Mar-a-Lago shortly before the president's second inauguration. He connected the 6'9" teenager with a tailor to get him suited for the day. They chatted in a canopy area while Trump, Don Jr., and Elon Musk circulated nearby. Barron is known to be a fan of Andrews, and Don Jr. once appeared on a live stream with Tate to promote a MAGA meme coin, saying, "You've got people attacking you, as far as I'm concerned." After the assassination attempt on Trump in July 2024, Tate told reporters that he was very close with the Trump family and had spoken to Barron about the shooting. The social ties between Tate World and Trump World runneth over from there. It all looked like a comfortable cultural fit. McBride and Waller attended Brusevitz's wedding this year, along with Levitt and Don Jr. and Nicki Minaj. When the Tates' travel ban was lifted, UFC CEO Dana White greeted the brothers at a Las Vegas fight by hugging them and saying, "Welcome to the States, boys." After the Tates' arrest this month, one leading far-right masculinity podcaster called on Barron to pull Pops to the side. But while former lawyer Alina Haba appeared on a podcast with Andrew in early 2025, describing herself to him as a big fan, the New York Times reported last week that when one of the brothers' representatives reached out to her hours after the arrest, Haba didn't respond. When the Tates were stuck in Romania, the jet-setting social media output that defined the Playboy image they were selling hit a significant snag. Content is stale, their cousin and business associate Luke Lilis said, according to a recent New Yorker report. We need Andrew and Tristan free. In the fickle economy of online fame, the Tates' total saturation had an inevitable sell-by date. After Andrew's recent arrest, his social media accounts published a three-hour-long video podcast that he had prepared in the event that he was arrested. But while the self-proclaimed most Googled man on earth claimed this week that he was struggling to read the signs being held up by supporters outside his jail, a content creator arrived on the scene, found only a single protester. With the 2024 election firmly in the rear view, the feverish hunt to weaponize the manosphere for political gain has largely subsided. What could be more wrung from the Tates at this stage? In some instances, Democrats have already sought to exploit Republicans' proximity to the brothers in the aftermath of the arrest. Arizona Congresswoman Yasemin Ansari called for an investigation into the Tates' ties to the White House, even requesting that Barron testify. Losing the Tates will not have an electoral impact going forward, conservative media strategist Nathan Brand tells Vanity Fair. Young men have bigger issues than what these professional provocateurs have to say about women and societal norms. They may disappear and another influencer will emerge, he adds. Life will go on. McBride, however, was adamant that his client's political influence had not waned and that Trump and his allies would regret turning their backs, citing an indecipherable conspiracy involving a collusion of local actors in Florida and the UK with low-level elements in the US government to explain their recent arrest. There were people who saw Andrew and Tristan in some very elite establishments in halls of power, he says, and some of their enemies didn't like that. It was similarly difficult to make sense of the McBride's claims that the Tates' legal troubles would make them the 2026 version of Nelson Mandela twins if they are incarcerated in England, even as he insisted that it might not come to that. That the White House press secretary's no was not as final as it sounded. Just because Caroline Leavitt gets up there and says Trump's not going to do anything, the lawyer says, Trump changes his mind like he changes his underwear. At the end of the day, he's going to do what the fuck he wants to do. Next up in the politics section, Lindsey Graham's funeral was a grand exhibition of his influence and his servility. Official Washington came to a standstill this week to mark the passing of a South Carolina senator who won massive clout through his subservience to more powerful men. This is by Aidan McLaughlin on July 29th. It's hard not to think, standing inside the Capitol Rotunda, surrounded by bronze statues of Andrew Jackson and Harry Truman, as the United States Army Brass Quintet plays a hymn about your own infinitesimal place in history. Lindsey Graham's is bigger than most, bigger even than many of the men and women in this room. On Tuesday morning, his colleagues in the Senate joined President Donald Trump's cabinet in the heart of the Capitol building for a grand tribute to the late South Carolina politician who died earlier this month at the age of 71. Senate Majority Leader John Thune and Vice President J.D. Vance delivered speeches before Graham's casket, which was draped with an American flag. Senator John Fetterman even put on a suit. The mourning of Lindsey Graham has been a two-day affair. It's brought official Washington to a standstill, upending long-planned drink dates and clogging the town's arteries with Secret Service roadblocks and long lines of black Cadillacs. It is a send-off, the likes of which this town rarely throws for a member of Congress, a testament to the place that Graham carved out for himself through decades of hustling in the House and then the Senate. He became a force in Washington by virtue of his insatiable appetite to be involved. He was constantly abroad, making 10 trips to the Ukraine since Russia's invasion. He was a fixture on television, appearing 63 times on Meet the Press alone, and he visited Fox News so often that viewers felt like they knew him. He never seemed to be far from Trump, golfing with the president as a matter of routine on his West Palm Beach course. The last distraction is what rounded out Graham's time in Washington. The grand nature of his funeral was a reward for the grand bargain of his career. His cynical conversion from Trump critic to unrepentant supporter. He was often described as a pilot fish to John McCain, sticking close to a bigger political animal, but in no time he swam over to the man who launched his career by insulting McCain's military service. Graham was transparent about his reasons for his spiritual awakening. He told journalists he befriended Trump, whom he once labeled a jackass and a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot, to be closer to power. His reward in life was vast influence over one of the most consequential presidencies in generations. In death, his MAGA conversion boosted the word count of his obituaries and paved the way for his statesman send-off. It's what he would have wanted. There was one character trait Graham shared with Trump, the desire to be a great man of history. And, like Trump, he saw war as a nifty shortcut. He was extremely hawkish. He never saw a war he didn't like, Trump said in his eulogy at Graham's funeral later Tuesday in Washington's National Cathedral. Sean Hannity, the Fox News host and longtime friend of Graham's, offered a more diplomatic assessment. Lindsay, he was often unfairly characterized as a warmonger. I've heard that false criticism a lot. It's not true. The truth is opposite. Lindsay desperately wanted and talked to the president about a lasting peace in the Middle East. Trump's remarks may have been more faithful to reality. Graham's last act was a sunny crusade in support of war with Iran. In documentary footage filmed before his death and obtained by the Wall Street Journal, Graham reacted to Trump's launch of the war with a child's glee. "Look what we've done here. I almost cried," he told the documentary crew, just after the first U.S. strikes rained death and destruction down on Iran in February. "How long have we been pushing this?" The answer was years. He found victory in what turned out to be the twilight of his life. During a round of, what else, golf earlier this year, Graham appeared to Trump's well-known desire to be seen as a historical titan on par with Napoleon or Joseph Stalin. He told the president he had a generational opportunity to take on Iran, according to the Washington Examiner. Trump did, and Graham was thrilled. In March, the senator predicted a quick war. The regime would begin losing control of cities within 3 to 4 weeks, he said, according to the journal, and help from the rest of the Arab world would create almost irreversible momentum for the U.S. campaign to topple the regime. Graham was wrong, but he was not chastened. He was a constant presence on cable news and in Trump's ear, promoting the war with the same cheery disposition with which he sold its initiation. He was at times even more bullish on war than Benjamin Netanyahu. Inside the National Cathedral, the Israeli Prime Minister sat a few rows behind Trump. He was cosseted by two Shin Bet guards, their faces shielded by face masks. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who received more support from Graham than maybe any other Republican in Congress, also made the pilgrimage and sat in a pew nearby. Both leaders met with Trump earlier in the day, and Graham would have been pleased with the reviews. The president said his meetings with Netanyahu was very good, and his meeting with Zelensky went very well. At the end of the service, mourners filed out into the heavily guarded streets of Northwest Washington. Miriam Adelson, the Republican mega-donor with generous supporters of Israeli causes, walked out with two aides who held her by her arms and helped her into an idling Mercedes. A few blocks away, a smattering of protesters waved Palestinian flags and carried signs condemning Graham's fondness for war. A man with a small Iranian pre-revolutionary flag nearby complained to a police officer about their presence. Along the streets in the shadow of the cathedral, posters for Hind Rajab, the 5-year-old girl allegedly killed by Israel in Gaza, have been pasted to lampposts. Rajab, who was among the most visible victims of the war, was traveling with 6 of her family members when a tank reportedly opened fire on their car, killing everyone but Hind. She waited for 4 hours to be rescued, her clothing smeared with blood. Forensic investigations later found that an IDF tank fired more than 300 times into the car. Rajab's body was found days later riddled with bullets. Graham saw Israel's violence, unlike the violence committed by America's adversaries, as inherently righteous. When a reporter once noted that Israel had flattened Gaza, Graham angrily shot back, "Just flatten it. We flattened Berlin. We flattened Tokyo." When the International Criminal Court brought charges of war crimes against Netanyahu, Graham is reported to have said to the top prosecutor that an ICC indictment is for Africa and thugs like Putin and not for a country like Israel or his friend Netanyahu. In a final ode to Graham, Hannity used his eulogy to rally support for Israel's wars. "He knew," Hannity said, "as President Trump knows, as Israel knows, as I know, there can be no path to peace until evil is defeated." The Fox News host, who knows how to appeal to the president just as well as Graham did, then addressed Trump directly. "Lindsay, Mr. President, arguably has a heavenly version of Mar-a-Lago. He may even have a little more gold in the Oval Office in his mansion in heaven, and I wouldn't be surprised if he added one big, beautiful ballroom and an arch somewhere on the property, because he would want to obviously duplicate his dearest friend in life, you, Mr. President." There was something both truthful and tragic about that conclusion. The departed South Carolina senator won his influence over world affairs and this grand funeral through subservience, and even in Hannity's conception of heaven, Graham exists not as his own man, but as an eternal supplicant to a more powerful one. We're going to go back in the vault for a Proust questionnaire with Stanley Tucci. This was originally published October of 2024, but Stanley Tucci is still in the zeitgeist, so I thought we would revisit that for the end of our time here. Vanity Fair asks, "What is your idea of perfect happiness?" "A meal al fresco with people I love." "Which historical figure do you most identify with?" "I would never presume to identify myself with any historical figure." "Okay, Michelangelo. I could only ever hope to be like that person." "What do you dislike most about your appearance?" "How much time do you have?" "In short, I would like to be younger, taller, and have my hair back." "What is your greatest extravagance?" "Face cream. I love La Mer." "Which living person do you most admire?" "President Zelensky." "What is the trait you most deplore in others?" "Cruelty. I don't see the point." "What is your greatest fear?" "Losing one of my children, as there is no greater loss." "What is your favorite journey?" "To the River Cafe. I love to walk to that restaurant along the Thames any time of year, in any weather. It is London at its best." "On what occasion do you lie?" "To make a child feel secure." "Which living person do you most despise? "Trump. Need I say more?" "Which words or phrases do you most overuse?" "My instinct tells me..." My wife and my business partner Lottie always laugh when I say it. Not sure why. Seems perfectly reasonable. "What is your greatest regret?" "Not being able to save my late wife and not being the best I can be at all times." "What or who is the greatest love of your life?" "My children, art, food." "Which talent would you most like to have?" "To be able to play the piano like Diana Krall and sing like Harry Styles." "What is your current state of mind?" "Occluded and exhausted from working too much." "If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be?" "I'd like to be more patient." "If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be?" "I would make my parents younger. I want us all to have many more years with them." "What do you consider your greatest achievement?" "That I've taught my children right from wrong, and that my work seems to have made a lot of people happy." "If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be?" "A jazz musician or sculptor. Making art is time well spent." "Where would you like to live?" "The Alps, because they never change but are different every day." "Who is your favorite hero of fiction?" "Captain America." "How would you like to die?" "Quickly, quietly, in my sleep, after a great meal with friends and family." This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for listening. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Thanks for listening and have a great week, everybody.